Welcome, everyone. So thank you so much for being here and taking the time to spend this afternoon talking about delightful multi-touch user experience. I also appreciate the fact that since you have like 500 other choices to pick from, you decided to come to this talk. And of course, making the trek out to the Hilton Garden Inn. A little bit off the path, but it's cool. I'm glad to see you here. So my name is Uday Gajendar. I am a principal product designer at Citrix. What I do there as a principal designer is basically deal with kind of the hands-on pixel interaction models, kind of dealing with actual multi-touch interaction, dealing with enterprise software, and actually creating products. Also supervising patterns, guidelines, and overarching kind of themes that shape our user experience, right? Also, I do a fair bit of evangelism when it comes to design thinking and also design strategy. And how does that unfold in an enterprise context, right? So with that, I'm actually going to just dive right in. What I want to do today is basically share three short stories of how we at Citrix have achieved multi-touch user experience. But first, I want to ask, how many of you here have heard of Citrix? Oh, good, everyone. Or almost everyone. How many of you actually use Citrix as part of your day-to-day? Oh, okay, cool, a few folks. I'm just curious, which apps do you use from Citrix? Like Zen App, Zen Desktop, Receiver, GoToMeeting? Yep, right. That's kind of our consumer-oriented brand. Yep, cool. So recently at Citrix, we've undertaken an initiative of kind of applying a very strategic user experience model, thinking about how we can really reinvent our products from a brand perspective, but also from a touch interaction behavioral model perspective. And so the three stories I want to share revolve around three basic themes, right? One is coherence, how to achieve something that is very cohesive and it feels very unified and integrated. The second is adaptation, so adapting a product so that it looks and feels like the device you're using it with, right? So imagine Windows 7 looking and feeling like an iOS native application on your iPad. So somewhat of a radical notion, so I'll talk a little bit about that. And then finally, precision. You know, we all deal with and we all struggle with kind of the fat finger kind of challenges of getting precise interaction on a phone or on a tablet. So we've developed some ways of compensating for that, which I think you'll find rather interesting and unique. So all of these stories, the three of them, constitute our kind of path, our journey, our strategy really, for achieving a delightful multi-touch interaction for enterprise software. And a lot of this dovetails right within our mission, which is to provide for a world where people can, you know, work and play from anywhere, on any device, any which way they want to. And this very much taps into the cultural zeitgeist of today, right? With the millennials and Gen Y individuals who, frankly, don't have the patience for dealing with kind of regimented bureaucratic structures and just having that freedom, that opportunity, and really having the autonomy to do what it is they want and to achieve it whenever they want to, getting back to this kind of work-life lifestyle balance, right? How can we support that while delivering a delightful experience? Now, for Citrix and our customers and clients, ultimately, it kind of boils down to accessing Windows, right, and Windows software, because that's frankly just how it is in terms of the corporate reality, being able to access Windows, Windows desktops, Windows servers, and, of course, Windows applications like your Office suite, or it could be SAP or it could be Oracle, anything of that nature, being able to do that from your iDevice, whether it's iPad, Android as well, or BlackBerry. Now, one of the fundamental struggles that we deal with at Citrix is that relationship between the enterprise context and consumer mindsets. Now, I'm guessing that most of you who probably have heard of Citrix or probably use Citrix probably operate in an enterprise context or know about the enterprise context, right? It's very typically, they tend to be very IT-driven, very kind of locked down, bureaucratic, a lot of regulation and policies, and for some fair reasons, right? You know, IT administration, they want to protect their assets, their IP, want to make sure there's no vicious malware, viruses, and all that kind of stuff getting into the system. But, you know, it can be frustrating. It can be annoying and difficult. And it really flies in the face of our consumer mindsets of today, which are, you know, shaped by things like the iPod, you know, the iPod, iPhone, et cetera, software like Dropbox and Evernote, which allow you that freedom to kind of access your notes or your files from anywhere, on any device, any time, Even just shopping at Target and you see really nicely designed products, or flying Virgin America. There's that sense of having something that is really beautiful, very delightful, and it takes away the stress and the frustration, the annoyances, right? And really create an experience where people can really be who they are and interact with the data on their terms, the way they want to do it. So there's a little bit of a conundrum there. How do you reconcile the enterprise needs for lockdown environments and also allowing for that consumer freedom? Ultimately, it comes down to autonomy, freedom, and empowerment. So how can we support that within a multi-touch environment? So that really represents the challenge that we have at Citrix. It really represents the journey that we've been under for the past 12 to 18 months or so, trying to figure out, okay, with this kind of new design strategy, new imperative around strategic thinking around user experience, and how to fold it into our processes, our philosophies, and our methods. So what does that entail? And so I'll dive right into that just now, but first, there is a quick little problem that we have to deal with. Unlike, say, designing a multi-touch app like, you know, Angry Birds or Instagram or something like that, there's something really interesting about Citrix products, particularly those that reside in the enterprise space. First, the data is not on your device. It's actually out in the cloud someplace in some kind of data center, right? In fact, what you see painted on your screen for your device basically are the pixels, right? They get scraped off and they get painted on the device. So it raises the question of, okay, what exactly are you touching? What are you interacting with? It can get a little bit profound, a little existential. So, you know, in this era of tap being the new click, in fact, the challenge we have is how do you translate taps into clicks, right? You're trying to access a Windows-based system, putting aside Windows 8 and all that stuff for the moment, but really is something that is not optimized for touch friendliness, and it's really meant for mouse-keyboard interaction. How do you translate taps into clicks? How do you support single-click, double-click, hovers, drag-and-drop interaction from the comfort of your tablet or phone? So that really is kind of the crux of the matter. And that's really kind of lies at the heart of each of the stories I'll be talking about today. So for the first case study is coherence. So how to create something that is very cohesive in terms of the visuals, in terms of the brand, and also in terms of the gestures and interactions. And this centers on a product that we provide called Receiver. Basically, it's a viewer. It's a free product. You can actually download it right now in the App Store or right after my talk. And it basically provides a view into virtual applications, virtual desktops, and your files and data. Now, I said virtual a lot. All that stuff, again, it lives on the data center, right? So your IT admin, they've set it all up for you. You've got your accounts all configured and secured. Now it's just a matter of pulling it down, right, and using Receiver as a way to view it. As part of our business strategy, we had this what we call a day one kind of approach, which was basically having all these variety of devices, touch devices, having access to Receiver. So that included all flavors of Android, Blackberries, iOS, Chromebook, even a thin client here and there. So we had about like 35 different devices that we wanted to support to interact with Receiver. And unfortunately, that led to having 35 different UIs. It was not a coordinated, choreographed effort at all. You see all kinds of different flavors of the UI, different kinds of interaction models, different IA, different labels, and even names. In one screen, you can see way in the back something called Dazzle, which was kind of a code name for a project, and it got released into the wild. Other places called Receiver. Other places, it's just a different kind of mishmash of interactions and UI styles. Clearly not a cohesive effort at all, and in fact, it was total chaos. Now, intuitively, we can look at those screens and say, yeah, of course, we need to get all on the same page. This is just not going to fly with our customers. But we did do our due diligence, and leveraging our internal research efforts resources, we conducted some findings. And, you know, just a few snapshots here. We looked into browse model. How do you browse to find that application? You really need to add Excel or Outlook or PowerPoint. Where do you find it? How do you browse around to get to it? And we had three different ways of doing it across three different platforms. Viewing an application. So once you've added it to your, we call it your favorites or your home, how do you view it? How do you access it? Then how do you pull it up and then actually interact? Again, way too many different models of interaction for that. And then finally, the app switching behavior, being able to switch between open apps you have running, which is, you know, inherent to Windows. People expect that to happen. We either did not support it in certain platforms, or the manner of doing it was confusing and hard to find out. So clearly, you know, we had way too many issues going on there. And so we did something that was, you know, I think was fairly rare for an enterprise environment, and that is actually taking a design-driven reset. And it's interesting about this photo of the reset button being kind of all rusty and crusty, because very, very rarely do companies do a reset, right? It really kind of stand back and say, look, our stuff is just all over the place. We really need to get together. And armed with the usability research findings, we're able to go back to executives. And this included the CEO, various SVPs, and the GM for the business unit for receiver, and say, guys, we really need to clean this up and figure out how can we get things on a better footing. So that led to a series of 9 to 12 months of intense collaboration. We did a series of workshops, summits, and also had some war rooms. With the workshops, this was very deep dive. We spent a week, literally 5 days together, cooped up in a room with the executives, and in fact, the CEO did drop by a couple times to give his thoughts and feedback. But this is where we really unpacked our existing products. So those like 25, 35 different UIs I showed you, we literally, we had a room almost this big, and we took like those whiteboards you see on the back and the front there, on the side, we filled them up with screenshots, printouts of every single UI. Yes, we consume lots of paper, sorry, but it really served a purpose, A, to lay out the interface for execs so they understood exactly what we're dealing with, and give everyone a chance to provide feedback. So we did sticky note exercises, you know, paint, you know, all the pros and cons, the negatives and positives. We had a lot of reds and not too many greens, which was quite telling. We also ensued with actual sketching activities, so breaking out into small teams, really focusing in on our core feature sets, and having some of these the product managers and VPs actually try out some sketching and actually kind of sketch out the interfaces as they would think it would be. And then, of course, we went back to the field, gathered some feedback. Meanwhile, we went back into our war rooms and, again, having very deep, intensive sessions, working with the PMs and engineers directly hand-in-hand and actually coding the stuff up, doing rapid, iterative prototyping, really trying to get a sense of, okay, what is this? And how will it behave? How will it interact? And of course, getting side-by-side comparisons of those screens across the different devices. That was really critical, so that everyone, including product management, including engineering, were all in the room, were all looking at the exact same thing at the same time, and were reacting accordingly. That was really critical for getting everyone on the same page. Now, simultaneously, now, so that was all for, you know, engineering, product management, and so forth, all working together. And like I said, the CEO dropped by and mentioned a few of his thoughts as well, which is very useful, by the way. Now, simultaneously and in parallel at various times throughout the year, we held summits. And these are internal mobile summits. We realized as a design team, we need to elevate our mobile IQ, our understanding of what does it mean to design for mobile, right? I mean, none of us graduated from school with a degree in mobile design, right? But we are armed with basic design principles, various user experience philosophies and approaches. So, you know, we spent some very intense time looking at the devices, looking through books and readings by the various notables, Dan Saffer, right, Luke Rablewski, Mobile First. We actually had Rachel Hinman from Nokia come in. She's coming out with a new book later this year. Fabulous set of ideas and methods of how to prototype very quickly for mobile constraints. And out of the conversations we had, we realized there are certain core principles that are really inherent to what we're trying to accomplish. For example, one of the things that we cite now is this notion of when in Rome. So when in Rome, do as the Romans do, right? So if you're on a certain device, let's say an iOS device, you want to stay true to the iOS paradigm and that model of interaction. If you're on Android, which has certain qualities to that, you stay true to that versus BlackBerry and so on and so forth. So that became one of our bedrock pillars. We also talked about scopes of consistency, right? It's not just enough to have one app look exactly alike across every single device. You really got to think about the scope of, okay, the product functionality, brand family cohesiveness, and then also jiving with the OS guidelines, right, and standards and so forth. So at various levels, maybe there's some leeway, some breakage and so forth, but we had some very productive conversations around what that would entail. And as we had our discussions, we realized, you know what, this has been done before. You know, we don't have to reinvent the wheel. There are actually quite a few model citizens we can reach out to and identify. For example, Netflix, Evernote, and Amazon Kindle. Netflix, you know, the ability to just pick up any device, start a movie, and then you can pick up another device and finish that movie, right? It actually remembers, having that kind of smart adaptation to it. Evernote is just beautiful and famous for having the round-trip synchronization of your notes, and similarly for the Amazon Kindle, and the way they support multiple devices, but it feels very fluid, feels very ubiquitous, which really led to our cornerstone principles of being ubiquitous, right? I mean, if you look at Netflix, Evernote, and Kindle, they're ubiquitous. They're on every single device, every single platform, almost. I'm not sure if it's everyone. They're very fluid, right? So getting back to, actually, I think it was Josh Clark who was talking about content flows. So that notion of fluidity of content, it just flows from one device to another, and it feels natural, feels seamless. And then finally, having a sense of personality, brand, right? You want to stay true to who you are as a company. People can be distinctive about it and reach out and say, oh, yeah, that's a Citrix product, right? Or an Evernote or Netflix or Dropbox or whatnot. And ultimately, it should all just work out simply. Sorry, that's all faded there. But that became our bedrock, our set of core principles. And this was presented to the CEO, who loved it, who loved how this was just a nice direct statement of who we are as a design team and as a product culture and what is it we stand for. So many iterations later, I'm just going to kind of jump to the end of having coherent vision. And this is the vision that it resulted. So if you remember, actually, I'll just skip over here. Sorry. Oops. Yep. So over here, you know, we had a variety, kind of a random mishmash of all kinds of UIs all over the place. We are now coming back to, actually, I'll go show this. We are now having a beautifully cohesive vision. So visually, it, you know, has a style and a persona and personality to it, but also the interaction model, the gestures, trying to keep that very coherent and consistent across the different devices. As you see, we're still supporting Android and iPhone, and of course the different non-touch devices as well, and being aware of that. So you can still have that round-trip experience as you go from a laptop to your iPhone to your tablet and vice versa, and still access your virtual apps, virtual data from anywhere. And just a really quick, fun, interesting note. This was actually recognized at the recent Global Mobile Awards. I think this was the GSMA conference recently. So I mentioned Angry Birds earlier. Yeah, so of course they always take top prize. But Citrix Receiver actually won Best Enterprise App, which was pretty cool. So it's really nice to receive that kind of accolade and recognition from the technology community, or the GSM community in particular. So with that, I actually want to show a quick demo. So I'm not, instead of risking, you know, a live onstage demo, I actually asked our chief demo officer, Brad, to just do a little vignette, do a little video. So I will show the short video clip in action, just to give you a sense of what Receiver is and how it works.
So let's start this by clicking Citrix Receiver on the iPad. When I do, it comes up, and on the right-hand side is the application list, folders full of applications that are brought to you by Citrix for Zen App. And when I click on these applications and add them as favorites, they'll jump onto this home screen on the left. Now I can click on Microsoft Excel. And when I do, it sends a command into the data center so that Microsoft Excel, Windows, of course, runs on a Windows server in the data center, and it sends its pixels to this display on the iPad. So with this, I can interact with it as though it is running on the iPad, and of course it's not. I can open a file, and it looks like it's running here. It's running in the data center. I can come up and look at the tab up above and see all the different helper applications up here that allow me to interact with this. In fact, the gesture guide. This reminds me, the single click, the right click, the keyboard, zoom, drag, alt tab. How do you do those things? Well, this reminds you the finger gestures to get those commands. Now, if I click in a data cell, I can pull up the keyboard and pop in some numbers. And here I am modifying the spreadsheet. So just like I'm on a Windows machine. The same thing happens on an iPhone. Click on Citrix Receiver on the iPhone. Shows me the folders full of applications. Office Productivity shows me Microsoft Excel. Click on that. Well, now those pixels that were being sent to the iPad are going to stop, and they're going to start being sent to the iPhone. And remember, it's not running on the iPad or the iPhone. It's running in the data center.
Okay, cool. All right, so I'll just stop it right there. So that gives you a sense of the kind of round-trip experience between the phone and the tablet and the ability to apply your touch gestures across the board. So you're able to learn it once, and then you know it, and you're able to use it very effectively. So let me move on to the next short story around adaptation. So, you know, as we were talking about earlier, the ability to run Windows on your iPad, that's a really cool thing. You know, that's really become the expectation of our clients or customers. But, you know, it's kind of fidgety, it's kind of funky, right? You have to kind of pinch and zoom a lot. Windows, at least Windows 7, is not really touch-friendly. You've got the little kind of controls and buttons and all that kind of stuff all over the place. And at least with Receiver, if you saw in the video, you know, Brad showed this toolbar that we have. That's something we're still trying to rationalize as we kind of make our further iterations. But, you know, the toolbars, they get in the way. You've got this floating palette, all these compensating maneuvers, right, to try to figure out how do you take something that's not touch-friendly and make it feel like that on your iPad. So we went back, and so we're kind of thinking, okay, is there a way we can really make it touch-friendly, make Windows touch-friendly? One thought that was thrown around is actually make it super big. It should really have really big, fat icons everywhere and big, fat scroll bars and all that stuff. And we were thinking, nah, that's kind of a super bad idea. So how about a different vision where we actually try to wrap Windows 7 controls within iOS, right? So in particular, if you think about the start menu, what if you could take the start menu and make it feel like an iOS control, a layer, right? Just like a pop-up layer or a pop-over layer. So you could actually tap on an icon, the layer comes up, and then you can just interact with it, basically having still a one-to-one mapping of your start menu controls, but it's rendered so it looks like a native iOS app, right? And it feels comfortable within the iPad. So this was somewhat of a speculative vision, kind of a what-if scenario that I conjured up with a couple other folks just to kind of see would people kind of react to this in a positive way. And ultimately what resulted out of that was a very positive reaction, at least from some initial kind of user feedback we got from some folks, to try this out, really try to make it happen and build a real product out of it. So we applied what we call, at least I guess affectionately internally, the three-in-the-box design model, right? So it's bringing design or user experience with product management, with engineering, all working together and being in the same room together so that you're making those choices, you're aware of the consequences, you're aware of the feedback, and you're aware of the impact that your choices will have, right? And you're avoiding this kind of back and forth email threads and all that kind of stuff. So we actually, again, this is one of those intensive workshop activities where we got together in the same room, hold ourselves up, you know, locked ourselves up for about a week. We actually conducted two sprints. I use the term sprint very loosely. It's not a full, true agile experience, but it was kind of a dedicated effort where we looked at, okay, the highest level, can we just map out what are the interaction models and looking at, okay, all the functionality of Windows that we really want to accommodate within iOS, for example, the start menu, the taskbar, and basic file folder navigation. We didn't really want to get into the details of, say, the sys tray and the control panels and stuff like that. You know, that's probably more of a V2, V3 kind of thing. But at least initially, can we get the main frame, if you will, of Windows 7 and make that really look and feel like an iOS app? So we did kind of a deconstruction, a total breakout of all that. Really encouraged the engineers to sketch the sketches that you see on the screen. A little bit washed out down there, but those are the engineer sketches. So we actually try to get them to actually try to think through the issues, come up with ideas, and have them kind of work out what the user experience model would be, and how do we map that back to iOS. And this required, again, getting back to elevating our mobile IQ. So it was funny, the engineers, they were saying they were not able to get budget to buy iPads. Well, I said, well, fine, we'll buy the iPads for you. you know, things of that nature, you know, really trying to get the tools and the resources in their hands so that they can actually try this and live this. That was one of the imperatives, getting back to when in Rome, you really got to live and breathe the mobile context you're designing for. Can't stress that enough. So, and just one example of the design iterations that we went through. So, again, the start menu, that's kind of a signature element of the Windows experience. So we wanted to achieve that for the iPad. So you can see, just kind of going, you know, from the backmost image moving up towards the front, that the original, and by the way, these are all screenshots from actual production builds. So these are not Photoshop comps. These are actual production builds. So the first one, the engineers literally just kind of spewed everything that they could think of. And just tried to put buttons here and there and everywhere, just make it really big and large and put them to the edges. Okay, they're kind of thinking about touch. That's good. It's a first attempt. But really want to add some grace and beauty to it and actually make it feel like an iPad application. So we started to iterate with more of a sidebar kind of approach and then actually bringing it up into a side panel that you drop down from the top. And then finally with the popover element with the proper gradients and icons and so forth. Now, what's really interesting about this process, at least from a toolkit perspective, is that we did not build this in iOS, using the iOS SDK and all that stuff. We actually did a roundabout way, because remember, the peculiar thing about Citrix technology, this stuff lives on a data center somewhere in, like, I don't know, Minnesota or Iowa or someplace. So you have this stuff living over there. It's not residing natively on the device so that we can improve our performance natively. So what did we do? This stuff is actually rendering WPF. So this is actually WPF that's being rendered on a server out somewhere in, you know, Minnesota or whatever, and being painted onto your iPad. Right? So that's how we were able to achieve that. And because of that, so it's, again, it's not a one-to-one mapping to iOS. It's a little bit of a hack. It's a little bit of a compensation maneuver. So we have to do a few little things. I don't know if you can see in that start menu there, there's actually a little scroll bar, right? Because we cannot do the actual true fluid kind of iOS interactivity. So we had to do little things like that, right? A little scroll bar, but it still gives you as much of a feeling as we can. And then for V2, we're hoping with additional technology improvements, we could actually make it more true and more native. We initially got some really great feedback. This was actually, I don't know if you, Brian Madden, he's a blogger in the enterprise space. So apparently he really enjoyed it, really liked it a lot when he got his hands on it last Christmas. It actually went out around Christmas of 2011. So again, let me just show a quick video of this in action so we get a sense of what this was. And it's interesting, the code name for this was Chameleon. So the idea is you're able to adapt it and make it hide and blend within the iPad application or iPad experience. So let me just run this video.
Let's start by clicking an icon that launches a virtual desktop in the data center. As it's Windows 7 running there, it's going to send its pixels across the network to the iPad and display here. I'll click on the Start menu, and you can see all of the normal standard window user interface that you would expect to see here. If we click on a WordPad application, it's going to open up. Everything looks pretty standard and normal. Up in the right-hand corner, we offer this soft icon up here. You click on that, and it changes the look and feel in front of you. A little softer, a little bigger, more touch-friendly. Now we have a Start menu we go into, click My Docs, and here we're going to open up an Excel spreadsheet. Looks pretty straightforward. We can work in here just fine. I'm going to minimize this and go back into this Start menu and even open up Windows Explorer. So it opens up Windows Explorer, and I can see all my libraries and data files on the bottom. Excel spreadsheets, Word docs, libraries, simpler, larger icons to click on to move between applications. I'm all done. I can minimize this down and see everything fine. Click on the Start menu. When I'm here, finally done, log off, yes, and we are all done with the desktop.
Okay, cool. Again, so what's interesting about that little video clip, again, we're still iterating and still evolving the builds. As you saw with the File Folder Explorer, it still looks like Windows. We're still trying to make it look like an iOS native app. So we're still trying to incrementally make improvements to that. But some pretty cool stuff there. So the last story I want to talk about is around precision. And this really deals with using the iPhone. So it sounds like quite a few know about GoToMyPC. So that's more of our consumer-based product. But more and more enterprises are using it as well to be able to access a physical PC remotely. And we have the GoToMyPC app out there available. And you know, it's been out there for a little while. You can actually use it. You connect to, let's say, your mom's PC to do some IT troubleshooting on the weekends, as is often kind of the use case. But what's interesting, again, another of the challenges is that, you know, it's a very shrunken and kind of interface, and you're trying to kind of, you know, tap, you got to pinch and zoom in order to get access to the controls, and you got to zoom out, all that kind of stuff. So it becomes a very kind of tedious interface. Yeah, you got the access to your mom's PC, and you can do what you want in terms of setting it up or whatnot, but it becomes very difficult in terms of precision, and we run into the whole fat finger syndrome, right? We deal with it all the time, right? It happens on our phones, being able to access the content and the functionality without accidentally tapping something else. There's also just the issue of gestures, right? So at least with GoToMyPC right now, how do you get to the right-click menu, right contextual menu, right? So you have to do a two-finger tap in order to bring up the right-click menu. That's not really popular with our users. Oftentimes they'll mistime the tap, and then it kind of screws up the timing, and then they're frustrated and all that kind of stuff. So we need to figure out a different way, a way that we can actually augment, again, that translation of tap to click when you're on your phone to access your PC. So, you know, our team, they did some research looking at, okay, various kind of target sizes. Are there ways that we can actually just improve the size of things, make them richer, larger, bigger, but without being too much in people's faces? So there's a bit of a sweet spot we're trying to hit. And after some thinking and some iteration and concepting and so forth, we hit upon this idea of a precision cursor. So, and you can see in that upper left screenshot there, we updated our gesture guide to include this little mouse cursor. So there is this cursor that actually you can actually kind of drag around, and it has big enough hit targets so you can actually do like a regular left click or even a right click, and then pull up your right click menus. Because as you know, with Windows, there are several right click menus and contextual menus and so forth. Also, hover effects, right? How do you do hover on touch? You can't right now, as far as I know. So as a compensating maneuver, we introduced this cursor so you can actually hover over elements and get tooltips, right, or any other kind of metadata being revealed progressively. So this became kind of one of our kind of interesting kind of benchmark UI elements that we've introduced with some positive feedback. Yeah, there we go. So it's interesting to see the reactions from customers who are now much more easily able to navigate through the space. Sorry, I know you can't read that. Easily navigate through the space. They're able to use that mouse and just be able to move a little more fluidly, more effectively through using their iPhone and also for the iPad as well. It doesn't resolve every fat finger issue. Sometimes there is occlusion with your finger and the content you're trying to interact with. That's just unavoidable. But in the main, this provides another way to interact with Windows that's served by the data center and be able to do it natively and fluidly on your device, which is pretty cool. So again, I will just show a short clip of this in action so you have a sense of what's going on here.
Well, here we're going to start off with a laptop. So with this is my primary laptop, and I'm going to open up documents folder and take a look at some documents that I have in here. And I can work, you know, all day long, and this is a great thing. But what happens when I go off into the world, and this is left either in the office or at home, and I need to get to it? Well, we're going to use GoToMyPC, and we're going to show it on an iPhone. So, download it to your iPhone and run it, connect it. Here it is connecting to that Dell XPS 13 Ultrabook. And as it connects, it's going to take over the screen and ask me for the access code. So as I put in my super secret Citrix 123 access code, it's going to completely take over the screen, turns green, shows me the gestures of how to move and drag and single and right click. And that's handy because when I'm down on a small screen like on an iPhone, you know, the finger gestures are key. Now, the other thing we do, we add a virtual mouse in here. So with that, I can right click on the virtual mouse on the desktop, and I can select new, and when I select new, then I can say, you know, I want to create a new folder. So I'll click on folder, and that'll open up a new folder on the desktop. That's handy. And you know what? I can bring down the virtual keyboard, and I can type the name of the folder, N-E-W, and now, you know, I've got a new folder called new. And now with that, I can double-click on that folder and open it up, and I can see it. So all of this connected to my remote laptop using GoToMyPC, displaying here. So I'm going to zoom in, and I am going to do something interesting. I'm going to click on a file, and I'm going to drag it and drop it from one folder to the other. So we can do that with that virtual mouse that we have there. So that's nice and handy. The other thing we can do with the mouse is I can bring it down to the corner of the folder. There you go. Click left, and I can hold and drag, and I can resize that folder. So this virtual mouse allows you to do all these things, including mouse overs. So I can see the tooltips here. As I take the mouse and I move it across the SysTray icons, I can see what the application names are below. Otherwise, you know, without, you know, tooltips and a virtual mouse, it wouldn't be able to do this on a touchscreen surface. Now look at this up on top of the screen. You can see all of the different helper apps up here also. And when I'm done, I can click X and say disconnect, and that is exactly what I do. So this will drop me right back into the GoToMyPC initial screen, and I'm back.
Okay, cool. That's it right there. So you can see with that video how the mouse cursor interaction, so being able to do a lot of the things you would expect with mouse and keyboard, with hovers, drag and drop, and of course right-click contextual menus, but doing it by virtue of having this kind of augmentation, this add-on, if you will, of the simulated mouse. So that proved very effective for us and for our customers and clients as well. So those are the three short stories I wanted to share around coherence, adaptation, and precision. And those stories, in a sense, while they represent certain themes of, you know, enabling delightful multi-touch interaction, they also represent strategies, right? Different ways of thinking about how you can do on your own projects or in products with multi-touch, how you can achieve something that is very delightful and also very kind of interesting, right? It adds to that the language and the parlance of what it means to create touch-based gestures and languages and so forth, right? So just to dive into some of the lessons learned out of each of these experiences, one of the big things that we really kind of dealt with is this whole issue around consistency and coherence. And I use that word coherence because we realize that with when you talk about consistency, at least with engineering teams, they took it to mean cookie cutter, carbon copying, has to be exactly this way every single time on every single device for every single UI. That's not always the case, obviously, especially when you look at something like an Android system versus an iOS system. There are certain qualities and attributes that are just different. Android phones, for the most part, have a back button, right? So how does that kind of deal with the interaction? How does that influence what you have to do in terms of adapting your behaviors and also the visual languages you have to create? So it's not so much about consistency as it is about something that is cohesive and it feels like a blended family, that all these elements at a UI level and also at a user experience interaction level, they feel like they come from the same kind of DNA and are bound by the same set of core principles. So that was one of the big things that we learned, change the language and really adopt something that was more true to what we were achieving. Summits and workshops. It's really important to have very deep, intensive collaboration efforts, whether internally as part of your design team, and this includes, of course, researchers, writers, and prototypers and so forth, or externally with the executives, with the VPs and managers, and even with your customers, and start engaging with them and making sure you factor in their feedback. It's really important. It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of preparation. I mean, I can tell you this. We faced quite a bit of resistance, some pushback with blocking out entire days on people's calendars, but we felt it was really important. And also just flying people over. While we have globally distributed teams, we have folks in Santa Barbara, UK, Florida, even Bangalore. It was really important. And yes, there is a little bit of an irony in the fact that we provide GoToMeeting software, which enables face-to-face interaction and so forth over the phone and through video. But you know, at the end of the day, nothing really beats having people in the room with you, hashing things out, grabbing the pen and sketching out on the whiteboard in real time, and having those kinds of conversation. It really matters. And again, it helps elevate your internal IQ, as I mentioned earlier. And if you get the opportunity, this is a great chance to bring in outside speakers. We had Rachel Hinman come in. She's a fabulous speaker. If you ever get the chance to meet her or invite her to come talk to your organization, really shared lots of ideas around mobile experience. Collaborating with executives, our CEO, we are very fortunate to have a CEO who really gets the value of design and is really trying to kind of marshal the effort of strategic design thinking throughout the organization and so forth. But he's got some opinions, some strong opinions. You know, he's really trying to advocate for a distinct model and a distinct brand and so forth. But he's certainly fair. And anyway, the point is that it's important to get your executives' feedback and get their ideas, get their opinions, and push back respectfully and politely. You know, if you have rationale behind your argument for why not to do something, you know, you should mention that and you should project it accordingly. But collaborating with executives is always a good thing. You never know where those good ideas come from. Working in a three-in-the-box model, again, this gets back to collaboration and teamwork. It's really important to have product managers and engineers in the room with you. This also includes QA. It includes docs and content writers, making sure they're in the room, at least aware and understanding of the decisions you're making, and providing feedback that factor into that decision-making. So they feel ownership. This gets back to kind of partnership around creating something that's delightful and meaningful for your customers. It's not just the designer coming up with a cool vision, but it's everyone executing and partnering together to deliver something meaningful. Constant research studies, usability studies. I showed you some snippets of what we had done in the past for the Coherence project. That's just something that we do ongoing, and it's always useful to have in your back pocket. There's never a time when it's just done and it's just stopped. You know, you should just always constantly flow in that feedback from your users and customers. It's always a good thing. And then finally, you know, it really pays to dare to be bold, be delightful. You know, it really does work. You know, it can be a risky, scary proposition to throw out some kind of crazy ideas out there. But, you know, recasting Windows 7 as iOS native app, you know, it's kind of a crazy idea. But we were able to corral and rally some executive support around that concept, and people bought into it, and were able to execute and get some good feedback. And some other ideas I showcased here. It does take quite a bit of effort, but again, just shepherding, just doing kind of the due process of politicking a little bit and kind of persuading folks around the value of your ideas does make it worthwhile. And just one more thing, as there's always one more thing. And this is just a really big shout out to the team that I've been fortunate to work with. It takes a really amazing village of, again, writers, researchers, prototypers, managers, developers, all collaborating together. It takes everyone's efforts. And it's not just one person, the lone genius designer. It really is everyone working together. Even if you're cross-global, it can happen. You just got to make that extra effort to pull people together around a workshop, around a summit, have those thought leadership activities, bring in the speakers, raise people's mobile IQ. And you can make it happen. So with that, I will open up to any questions or comments. I forgot to mention the hashtag at the very beginning, but hopefully you caught it, BizTouchUX. My tag is actually at Udanium, or you can just email me directly. We have a microphone in the center, so if you have any questions, please step up, and happy to take any comments, questions. Cool, thank you.
Working with a company that has a lot of legal and compliance issues to deal with, like a bank, for instance, do you have any advice sort of going around trying to sort of redesign IT and redesign consumer-facing technology in that area?
Can you clarify just a little bit, or is there a specific example?
When you have sort of a lot of extra security needs and things like that, it's sort of sometimes what's available to you isn't always it's hard to kind of balance out what's best for sort of kind of your security and your legal and your compliance teams
and what's
best for your internal people and your customers.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. Cool. That's a great question. In fact, I actually just recently co-authored internally a paper with our content editor around security and UX. How do you strike the balance between the two, particularly when it comes to IT administration and the fact that so many things have to be locked down and protected and so forth. And, you know, what we're realizing is that, yes, you have to constantly, well, a couple of things. One, you have to constantly be in touch with, certainly with the IT admin folks. So for these projects, you know, we reached out to them to get their kind of initial kind of feedback and concerns, anything that's a total red flag that would kind of inhibit the overall design process and so forth. So reaching out to them, making sure they're checked in terms of the process, and they're aware. So if you follow kind of the what we call the DACI model, driver, acceptor, contributor, informed. So we consider the IT admin folks as more either the contributor or informed. So they're not the approver, but they're someone that we need to be aware of their concerns and their feedback. So it's just a matter of constant check-ins with them. With regards to legal aspects, it wasn't too much of a big deal for us. The only legal thing is filing patent protection on these ideas. And I don't know if you noticed with regards to the Windows, adaptation story, trying to recast Windows to look like an iPad app. If you noticed, that little button at the upper left, it said start, spelled out start. We didn't exactly get quite the approval for a Windows logo right there. So there are certain assets we were unable to use, but we had to do other compensating maneuvers to take care of that. So, yeah, but that's a great question. Always keep them in the loop and keep them informed. Yep. Cool. Any other questions, comments? Cool. All right. Well, thank you all very much. Really appreciate it. Take care.